We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
The dignity of humanity. That was Lyndon Johnson there, of course. And without question, Bernie Sanders is a progressive in the great Democratic Party tradition, like the LBJ tradition, except, of course, for his war in Vietnam. But Bernie Sanders is in that tradition. And there's no question that is one reason he did. There's no question he did so incredibly well in the state-by-state primaries. The Clintons have never claimed to be in that tradition. They're a different kind of Democrat. In the 1990s, something new came into being, the Democratic Leadership Council. And that came out of the recognition that great amounts of money were needed to win elections. So the new tack was to go straight to those interests that have a lot of money, profit-driven corporations and the people behind them. That was a lot easier than the hard work it takes to raise enough money from many average income people. Of course, the Clintons were part of that new Democratic faction. Who could have imagined that in 2015, 2016, Bernie Sanders could raise all the money he needed from millions of people with an average contribution of $27. So here we are, just before the general election, and Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party. And on a great many issues, she is to the right of Bernie Sanders and the bulk of activist Democrats who are the grassroots of the party. Of course, for the sake of America as we've known and loved it, it is essential that we defeat the fascist, racist, outrageously sexist Donald Trump movement. And at this point, polling suggests she is likely to win, which would be a tremendous relief, of course. But would a non-traditional, non-liberal Hillary Clinton presidency, what would that look like? Can she be pushed to the left, to the traditional Democratic positions, as most Democrats hope? What will it take? And on what issues does she really need pushing? What would her priorities be if Hillary Clinton is, in fact, elected? Our guest today is Arun Gupta. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. You'll have to excuse me. I have a little bit of a cold.
I could tell. Arun Gupta, well, good luck with that. It's fading into toward the winter. Well, Arun Gupta is a graduate of the French Culinary Institute in New York. He's never invited me over for dinner, unfortunately, and has written for publications including The Washington Post, The Nation, Salon, and The Guardian. He's author of the upcoming Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, a Junk Food-Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. Gupta writes in his recent column in Yes magazine that this time we can envision a truly progressive Clinton administration policies on health care, immigration, student debt, and climate change. And movement leaders are gearing up to make sure and to push. The time is ripe to envision a truly progressive policy agenda and plan how to organize it under a potential Clinton administration. Again, thanks for being with us. It seems to me there are a lot of battle lines ahead for any move to push Hillary Clinton back to what I would call the center, what Arthur Schlesinger in 1948 called the vital center, meaning social programs were necessary and free market capitalism where it functions well to serve the common good. Since that time, especially under Presidents Reagan in the 80s and Bill Clinton in the 90s, the big money powers that Franklin Roosevelt, who really defined liberalism, warned us about gained a tremendous amount of political power. Roosevelt tried to take them on, and unfortunately, it seems that they have taken great deal of power and have seen government as their appendage of their power, a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate power. Based on her positions as espoused thus far, Arun Gupta, how far off from traditional liberalism is Secretary of State Clinton?
Well, there are two things. First, very far off. I think if folks have seen the Saturday Night Live skits with, the actors, Alec Baldwin playing Donald Trump and other actor playing Hillary Clinton. And in the last skit they did in the third debate, the Hillary Clinton character at the end says, you know, you have a choice in this election. You can vote for the Republican, me, Hillary Clinton, or Donald Trump. Basically, Clinton's policies in the 1990s, Bill Clinton fulfilled the Reagan Revolution. We had NAFTA, we had the destruction of the social welfare system, the deregulation of the telecommunications industry, of Wall Street, of commodities futures, mass incarceration, repressive laws in terms of immigration reform, effective death penalty and terrorism act. It was just one right-wing policy after the other. Now, we've seen, I've been saying, you know, Clinton, Hillary Clinton now has been essentially forced to repudiate pretty much all of those policies, but she still is a neoliberal warmonger. When we see what she wants to do in terms of, like, college debt, right? That's one of her big plans. It's still to keep people in debt. They'll go on to these income repayment programs, and they may pay a lower part of their income, but it's not the taxpayer-funded higher education that we should have, or in terms of the health care. It's these very complicated, jerry-rigged systems rather than, you know, saying, no, everyone should have to pay in, particularly the rich, and healthcare should be a basic right. It's still these neoliberal schemes that she's promoting. But the other side, I think we have to really remember, it's just like, sure, Keynesian capitalism, you know, where the state would come in and regulate the business cycles. It was better than what we have now, but there were still huge swaths of the population who were left out of it, right? You know, this did not cover African Americans. This was also the era of Jim Crow. Chicanos, Native Americans, women were second-class citizens, you know, and there was still very much poverty in the inner cities and rural America, not as much as it was now. So that was a very incomplete system, and it was also predicated upon the super exploitation of the third world, of the developing world.
Oh, yeah. That's still going on. And it might be useful, Arun, to define neoliberal. I think people have a pretty good understanding of the term liberal. You know, I certainly am. Lyndon Johnson was a liberal. Certainly Bernie Sanders, a traditional liberal, but how would you define neoliberalism? That's something else entirely.
Okay, so this is a different use of liberalism. This
yes,
is a 19th
very much so.
Century European sense in terms of laissez-faire, you know, that unregulated markets. And so neoliberalism, what it kind of refers to, it comes into being with the Reagan and Thatcher era, and also, you know, dictators such as Pinochet and Deng Xiaoping, head of the Communist Party in China. Basically, that the profit making and wealth accumulation are the most important facets of economic policy. Right. That those are the end goals of economic policy. Hmm. Now, usually people think of neoliberalism in terms of the tools of neoliberalism. In other words, trade liberalization, the free flow of capital, right? You can make money anywhere in the world and repatriate or hide the profits, deregulation of consumer, environmental, health, workplace safety laws, the ideology of personal responsibility. But neoliberalism, it's really what it's about is it's a system of class power, by those with a huge amount of money. And we've seen this massive polarization such that, for instance, in American society, you have the six heirs to the Walton fortune. That's a family who essentially owns Walmart. They're worth over $200 billion. They have more wealth than something like 150 million Americans. And so that is a type of just unimaginable polarization that we're talking about that has been created in the last 40 years.
And the neoliberals are all for that. They buy into that. It's, again, very, very different from what most people think of as traditional liberalism. It's kind of just acquiescing to, frankly, it seems to me like what Americans fought the War of Independence to gain freedom from. Because back then, in the late 18th century, the government was owned and controlled by the royals, by the aristocrats. They had all the power. The government didn't even pretend to serve the common good. It was government by that. And we had a revolution against that. And it seems that that's kind of been reinstated and is kind of what neoliberalism is, running the world, as you mentioned, the Pinochets, just serving the corporate interests. And Hillary, let's face it, is not taking that on. In fact, it seems pretty clear, during the primary season between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, she really was there on the side of the neoliberals and the Wall Street people. But certainly she was pushed. She has been pushed. She's moved a little bit away from that, calling, at least saying the words about taxing the wealthy people, the wealthy interests more than they have been. Having them, making them pay their fair share. Bernie Sanders pushed her to do that. And what we're talking about now is, can she be pushed even more on other issues? And our guest, Arun Gupta, has written about areas in which she might be able to be pushed. And the Bernie Sanders campaign certainly had tremendous support from young people. The reasons for this may be pondered by pundits for a very long time, but one specific factor has to be Bernie Sanders' position on free, quality college and debt cancellation. Different from Hillary. Sanders had every right to crow about the 2016 Democratic platform being what he called the most progressive Democratic Party platform ever. And again, this is the platform, which is sort of a contract that perhaps we can hold a President Hillary Clinton to. After Bernie made free tuition such a big issue, the eventual nominee, Hillary Clinton, seemed to adopt his position. What is the reality on this? What are some of the differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton's positions on free higher education? You touched on this a little bit, but maybe you can go into a little bit of the specifics on that.
Well, so, the most progressive platform ever. At one point, I started going back and looking at earlier Democratic Party platforms in the post-World War II era. And a lot of it is hard to compare because you don't have these huge platforms in the past. Usually, it would be like maybe a page of proposals. And also social issues were not really at the fore as the way they are now, right? There might be, in 1948, there was a little language about civil rights, but I don't think it was even called civil rights back then. And certainly nothing about gender equality or transgender or, feminism, nothing like that. So it's, you're, in a way, you're comparing apples and oranges. But on the economic policies, often the Democratic Party platform was much more progressive in the past. In, I think it was 1948, the Democrats did call for this, just about a near doubling of the minimum wage. They also called for a lowering of Social Security for women, and I think something like a 50% increase in benefits in Social Security. So, you know, it's this idea that it's the most progressive ever is just not true. Mm. In terms of Bernie Sanders' proposals, he simply wanted to he wanted to tax the rich, right? He was much more about wealth redistribution, you know. And of course, what we have seen in the last 40 years is this enormous wealth redistribution upwards. And his ideas was, well, we need to start to do it the other way. But part of the complicated thing about Bernie Sanders is we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves and think that, oh, there's this kind of like one-to-one causal relationship. By that, I mean that people, his supporters were like all like, yes, we want these redistributive policies. We want the single payer healthcare. We want, you know, the taxpayer funded higher education.
Right.
What you find is a lot of people were supporting him because they found that he was honest, he was authentic, he was very likable.
Yes.
You know, there isn't actually good data showing that millennials are more supportive of wealth redistribution than other generations are, older generations of American. The data is really doesn't show that at all. Certainly, I think you could say, yes, Bernie Sanders supporters are supportive of that. But, you know, the data is more complicated. In terms of, you know, what we're talking about moving Clinton to the left, what I did is I talked to leaders of various movements, or leading activists and thinkers, people organizing around student debt, single-payer health care, immigration reform, and climate justice movement. And for them, the question was, you know, like, none of them had anything positive to say about Clinton, right?
Yeah.
You know, they felt that she does pursue these very destructive right-wing policies, but for the most part, they felt it was likely there would be more space under a Clinton presidency. But the question is upon the movements for them to mobilize.
Right.
You know, that is a real question. I covered the Occupy Wall Street movement across the country in 2011. I visited more than 40 occupations in 27 states. And someone in Washington, D.C. made a very sharp observation, about electoral politics. They said to me, elections are about moving a candidate. Movements move the whole system, right? And so that's the question, like, if Clinton does win, which I think she is still likely to do, she has a pretty good firewall, even though it's going to be much closer than it was a week ago. It's a question of, can the movements create the pressure to push her to the left? Now, you also have the problem of this, you know, just really extreme right-wing Republican Congress, and there'll also be the lingering problem of Trumpism, this
Yes.
kind of proto-fascist movement that is in favor of ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
You know, we could get into this if you like. You know, I think people... The media has not done a good job. I've covered the Trump movement across the country. I've been to numerous rallies and events, seen him speak live multiple times, interviewed over 100 Trump supporters. And Trump is really running on a platform of ethnic cleansing. That is the core of his appeal. And that is not going to go away.
Wow. No, it isn't going to go away. And I hope that if Trump loses, and I hope, of course, he does lose and lose badly, that, you know, the people... On November 9th, that the governors are ready to call out the National Guard if necessary, because people, you know, his people, They are determined to win. They don't understand nor respect democracy. They won't get it. And the Trumpist movement, as you say, the ethnic cleansing, that is going to continue. And I've seen it, too. That is what it's about. And I wanted to try to get back to some of the, you know, where we might be able to really push Hillary Clinton on. And I agree, it's certainly going to take a lot of heavy lifting. And people oftentimes, I think, don't believe we have power. People feel like we are powerless. They've been told, you're powerless. And most people believe it. I don't think we are powerless. But back to the free tuition thing. I mean, I know what Bernie said. I mean, I know Bernie a little bit, that, you know, he was for free tuition for community colleges anyway. What is Hillary Clinton's position on this that we might have to push her on, and that hopefully a strong Bernie Sanders will push her on?
Well, she's also said the same thing about making community colleges tuition free. One of the movement leaders I talked to, Ann Larson, of this group called Strike Debt, which folks should check out. Kind of originated with Occupy Wall Street, this project called Rolling Jubilee, where they were buying bad debt to show the problems with the, you know, system of student and medical debt. She was explaining, it's just like, look, you know, this is about maintaining a neoliberal education system. You know, it's just like, of course, college tuition should be free, but the problem is what they want to do is funnel working class students and students, you know, people from people of color into the community college system. So we create this kind of tiered higher education system. You know, and the community colleges are underfunded. They don't have as much resources. You know, then you have the four-year educational institutions for the middle class and the elite institutions, the Ivy League institutions, the, you know, the top tier, you know, public universities like Caltech or Berkeley or University, you know, wherever, that get all the huge amounts of funding, huge amounts of resources. That's where the children of the wealthy and the powerful go to. So it's very much as multi-tiered, stratified educational system. You're not addressing the class inequality. Sorry, you're just reinforcing it.
I hate when people get sick this time of year. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Live, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with our guest, Arun Gupta, about where Hillary Clinton might be able to be pushed if she does get elected. Because she's, you know, no flaming liberal, that's for sure, except maybe on some easy social issues. But where can she be pushed? How should she be pushed? And how we can start to take that on. Immigration reform is a big issue. If she wins, as I certainly hope and pray she does, because Trump is a threat to basic America, as far as I've known it. Anyway, if she's wins, it'll be largely due to support from the Hispanic community and the African-American community. And you write that once in office, Clinton says her priority is a bill for comprehensive immigration reform with a pathway to full and equal citizenship within her first 100 days in office. There have been many varied attempts at immigration reform. What kind of immigration reform do you expect her to push for? And how might it be different from what you and I might like to see?
So, you know, we've had all this talk about comprehensive immigration reform, pathway to citizenship. This whole immigration movement kicked off. You know, we have to go all the way back to about 2006 or even earlier, when there was the Sensenbrenner bill. And what that was going to do was criminalize undocumented immigrants. It would put them at, you know, immediate risk of being arrested. And then you had the massive outpouring in 2006, you know, where you could argue this was like possibly the one real general strike in U.S. history, where we saw these just huge walkouts in cities like Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, that shut down work for the day in thousands of businesses. And so there was all this talk about, you know, immigration reform and a pathway to citizenship, but it never happened. And Obama was supposed to do it when he came into office, but they put all their energy into the health care bill, which has, you know, turned out to be just a complete mess.
Yes.
And so there was never anything done. But then meanwhile, Obama, you know, he ramped up deportations because logic was as well, he has to, you know, appear tough on immigration if he's going to reach a compromise. And so then we start getting these series of executive orders such as DACA, which is a deferred action for childhood arrivals. And then DAPA, which is for parents. And that would have potentially covered about 5 million immigrants and removed them from the shadows. DAPA was basically is on ice. You know, it was the courts issued a stay, and then the Supreme Court, because it's split, was unable to rule. It was a 4-4 ruling. DACA is still in effect, but that only covers, you know, potentially it covers 1.7 million immigrants who arrived as children, but you have to apply. And apparently only about, I think, 700,000 or 800,000 have applied. And the total of undocumented immigrants is something like 12 million. What Clinton can do is issue more executive orders and broaden the program, but she would also need to get in a new Supreme Court justice, and so it would take a significant time. The other thing she could do is to essentially stop enforcement of various programs. You know, that's under the control of the executive branch, where they ramped down the huge deportations, the raids. You know, to be fair, the deportations have actually dropped considerably. And, you know, I would never defend Obama's policies, but you have to look at the actual data. A lot of what's going on in these deportations it's people who are being apprehended as they cross the border. That, especially in the last few years, has been the vast majority, and then held and deported rather than mass roundups in communities. That's what Trump wants to do. Yes, you know, basically, he wants to create this deportation force of brown shirts and just go in and raid communities, force cities by withdrawing federal funds to drop sanctuary cities, and, you know, really just create this general warfare on undocumented immigrants. So these are very different policies. You know, that's not to defend the Democrats' policies, but one is demonstrably much worse than the other.
Right, and it's going to take some pushing, no doubt about it. And I remember something called the DREAM Act, which was supported by a lot of young Hispanic people and came close to passage in 2010. What was the DREAM Act, and where might Hillary Clinton be on you know, the elements of that?
Yeah, that's what activists are calling for is taking kind of the smaller bits of legislation and trying to get that through, such as the DREAM Act. And what that does is basically anyone who arrived as a child, right, because they didn't have really a say in this matter, they, you know, and then they have to do certain things, like they have to go to complete like 2 years of community college or military service, and then they'll be given a permanent residency status, which you know, puts them on the path to citizenship. So the activists are suggesting that they take off, they do smaller bills or one what's called an ag jobs bill.
I was going to ask about that.
Been kicking around Congress for well over a decade to give more protection to immigrants who work as agricultural laborers. And of course, you know, there are plenty of farms who, so, you know, these corporate farms who do support that policy. But that's a mixed bag also, because plenty of corporate farms also like to have these shadow workforces that they can super exploit, you know, because there's just no way you're going to get a comprehensive immigration reform through a Republican Congress. And so activists are saying, you know, let's not keep repeating these mistakes and then, you know, losing the momentum. Let's, you know, push for what we can. And we have to build the movement that we can get the greater gains down the road.
Yeah, that's always the one of the many difficult things is what's realistic. You know, one can go along to get along. The Republicans would like that. And chances are we'll still be a Republican, at least House of Representatives. We can hope for the Senate, but I don't know about that. But, you know, one could argue that, okay, you got to compromise, and go along to get along. Or push hard. I don't think Obama pushed nearly hard enough on many, many different things. He compromised too easily. But of course, Clinton, I don't get the impression she's going to be very different. And if she wins, pushing hard. You know, there was an old saying in 1968 in the student worker uprising in France, some graffiti that said, "Be realistic, demand the impossible." And then settle for, you know, what you can get along the way. Clinton, if she wins, is going to have to be pushed and pushed hard. And Arun Gupta, you write that Clinton could exercise her executive and administrative powers to stop enforcing the deportation programs that currently rely on local police and encourage racial profiling, such as the Priority Enforcement Program and the Criminal Alien Program. I've heard that, as you mentioned, Obama has deported far more undocumented immigrants than Bush or any prior president. How much should we expect her to differ on this? And early on, I seem to recall her saying that children should be sent back, even if they're fleeing actual violence, like from Central America, El Salvador, and places like that. How much should we expect her to start out differing on this deportation issue, do you think?
Well, the immigrant rights activists have already pushed her to the left significantly. Her policy now does call, you know, and yes, these are all promises. She shouldn't be trusted. But I think part of the positive thing that's happening now is, you know, there was this honeymoon period after Obama was elected. There's not going to be a honeymoon period even for a second with Clinton, for better or for worse, right? You know, certainly the left's not going to trust her, but, you know, the House Republicans are going to start investigations from day one.
Right.
It's just going to be they just want to create constant chaos at this point.
I know.
But in terms of what her stated policies are, she's now calling for an end to family detention. Was taking money for private prisons. I believe she returned that money or donated it to like women's groups, and now is calling for ending private prison.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people should look at these as victories. Right now, they're just rhetorical victories. You know, they're on paper, but there is the possibility of now implementing them, of holding her accountable and translating them into actual, like, material gains.
That would be nice. That would be nice. And, you know, there's so much political capital any new president is going to have. And obviously the left is going to push her one way. And the Republicans, as you say, just want chaos. They would stop anything she'd like to do. And I think one of the realities is, I mean, she knows politics, that if she wins, she's going to owe a lot to the Hispanic voters. There's no question about that. I mean, many, many different states. So I would think, I would hope that that could be one constituency that could effectively push her. And I wonder, what other interests do you expect to be able to push Clinton to the left on immigration reform? Any other particular groups? And how difficult do you think it will be to move her toward a more progressive policy, specifically on immigration policy? Like what groups?
Well, this is really a movement that is led by immigrants for obvious reasons, right? You know, just like Black Lives Matter is right. led by African Americans. Certainly, there's a lot of broader support, and that is key to making the wider changes. You have to get mass support. I think
yes.
you know, encounter you know. Plenty of radicals, I think, who are well-meaning, who think all you have to do is have, you know, your radical stance and that's enough. And it's just like, no, you know, it's not going to change unless you have an actual strategy and you can actually organize a mass movement where you can get tens, hundreds of thousands
yeah.
of people in the street.
It does work.
And who reflect millions and tens of millions
yes.
of supporters.
Yes.
So, you know, hopefully we'll see big marches and protests in Washington, D.C. Around this issue to really put the pressure. And what it really involves is you have to have a disruptive protest. You know, this
yeah,
is
true.
The great sociologist Frances Fox Piven, who's written, who spent her life researching social movements and political change. Her theory is that you need movements that disrupt the system, such
yes.
as, you know, the sit-down strikes, the welfare rights movement in
yes.
the 1960s,
oh,
Black
yes.
Lives Matter. Today, that's where you start to see the type of political and social change that actually benefits people
yep.
instead of the wealthy and powerful.
That's right. I couldn't agree more. You need to have the disruptive protests, and people have way too much. You know, gotten away from that and feel like that don't do anything, but it does. Disruptive protests can work. Of course, the most powerful weapon of all is the one that's most difficult to pull off, and that is a general strike. That is tremendously powerful, and well, you know, as I say, it's really, really hard to do. The closest.
Well, you know, that's a good point. You know, in terms of what other groups could be taking the lead, it's unions, right? Unions
yes,
are really
yes.
key in a lot of this.
They are.
You know, it's just like. We should not think of these 12 million undocumented immigrants as immigrants. They're workers.
Yes.
You know, why are they coming here? They're coming here for jobs.
Yeah.
I've interviewed plenty of them. You know, they're fleeing often poverty and strife. I've talked to mothers, you know, who watched a child starve to death. And decided, you know, they had like, you know, three or four other children and just be like, I cannot subject my other children to this. You know, I'm working and yet I cannot even feed them. And so they come to the U.S. In search of jobs.
Sure.
This is
it's
about
tradition.
A labor issue, you
yeah.
know, and Black Lives Matter also that we have seen some crossover with the low wage workers movement, you know, because when you're talking about who are low-wage workers, that's especially the minimum wage and sub-minimum wage workers, that is a brown workforce, that is a largely female workforce.
Mm.
And so the Fight for 15 movement, which is
right.
Organizing for a $15 national minimum wage and for union for fast food workers,
right.
That's very, very heavily African-American. And they have made linkages with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so we've also seen some of that with immigrant rights organizing. So it's also going to take, I think, rank and file activists pushing their unions to get out in front more of this. I would highly recommend, but people should not have any illusions, right? I
yeah.
think that's one of the most important things. is not to just think like, oh, you know, people are going to do the right thing.
No.
Look at the WikiLeaks. This hasn't gotten nearly as much attention as it deserves.
What's that?
But there's been a good bit of reporting on just the labor angle, and you find all these union leaders who are just in bed with the Democratic Party,
yes.
Who are willing to go along with the policies that hurt the working class. And, you know, this comes out in the emails or, you know, that they won't pressure Clinton to take a positive stand. There are cases such as the Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, starts volunteering to the Clinton campaign that she'll attack other unions, such as National Nurses United, because they support Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And this is really just kind of despicable behavior.
Wow.
You know, and frankly, I've done a good bit of labor reporting, and you know, sometimes the evidence is the only conclusion is some labor leaders are really working against the interests of the working class, of the workers themselves. You know, they are no friends of the working class, just like the Clintons and the Democratic Party really aren't any friends of the working class. They're not as horrendous as the Republicans.
Right.
But, you know, when you find union leaders, that is just really... It's not just disappointing, it's sobering, and people should realize that this is a battle that has to be fought on many fronts, that, you know, we need to have militant rank-and-file reform caucuses that actually change the unions also and make them act more in the interest of their workers, of their members, that act according to real kind of... union democracy rather than, you know, just these top-down bureaucratic, almost corporate-style organizations.
Yep, which we've often had. This show is called Keeping Democracy Alive, and it's got to include economic democracy as well. If you just tuned into Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Arun Gupta, and he writes often for the Washington Post, The Nation, Salon, and Guardian, and we're talking about how Clinton might be able to be pushed to what used to be the center, what we would call the left. And certainly, I think the potential that you're talking about here is huge, really. The unions, you're right, a lot of them have enabled divide and conquer so that the wealthy and powerful interests divide up working people. That's how they keep in power. But you know, when you mention Black Lives Matter, the reality is they have been linking up with Palestinian rights groups. And there's all this different cross-fertilization, if you will, between groups that really are focused on these issues. And noise has got to be made. One of the big issues that Hillary Clinton is known for, you know, in the early 90s when she was first lady, a weird term if there ever was one, but when she was the wife of the president, she was well known for pushing for revamping our healthcare system, or non-system, as the case may be. Of course, the traditional liberal Bernie Sanders made universal healthcare, Medicare for all, a central part of his campaign. And of course, I think that is what we need. Senator Clinton has said she is for, quote, universal quality, affordable healthcare, unquote. What does she mean by this? How much power does she currently yield to the for-profit health insurance industry, do you think? And I wonder how much she's going to need to be pushed on this particular issue.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. You know, the whole thing about the ACA, you know, what everyone calls Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is that it was designed by the for-profit healthcare industry. You know, the rationale of the Democrats was is just like, well, the Clinton healthcare reform was a disaster because it was opposed by the healthcare industry.
Right.
So we need to have them on board. And so what it was really about was getting them on board, and so they could design it such that they get more patients and more money.
Yeah, there you go.
And so now, though, what we've seen at this point, because it was this incredibly complicated system of exchanges, that and these fines that it didn't work out as planned. Surprise, surprise. You know, it's just like you need to have a simplified system where everyone is in it, such as single payer, or even better. You know, let's not forget, single payer is not the end goal. We should have a system of socialized medicine.
Yes.
There are important differences between the two.
Interesting.
But single payer would be a great advance, but it's still not, you still leave in place private insurance systems. You know, it's just that you combine all the purchasing and revenue and payment.
Right.
But so, in any case, the system that we do have gives the insurance and the for-profit healthcare industry, it gave them huge new revenue streams, and it didn't work out as planned. So what we see is, you know, just these big spikes in prescription drug prices, as well as all these insurance companies that are dropping out of the exchanges claiming they can't make any money. Of course, they're making huge profits, you know. Don't cry any, shed any tears for these companies and their executives who are raking in millions, tens of millions, hundreds
profits.
Of millions of dollars a year in profit. And so what Clinton's, again, it's just like kind of, there's a lot of vagueness on it. You know, she talks about looking into things. You know, she does talk about, like, trying to bring down prescription drug prices. There's a discussion of a public option. But part of the problem, and I talked to this, I talked to Margaret Flowers, who's been one of the leading advocates. She's a pediatrician, a physician in Maryland. She's actually running for the
Senate seat,
U.S. Senate seat on the Green Party.
Right.
And she said, like, look, you know, at this point, the insurance companies would love nothing more than a public option.
Right.
By this, she means that a public insurance system where they can dump the sickest patients onto the government.
Right.
But then what you have happen is this creates a crisis. You just delay the crisis because the government takes up the patients who have the highest costs, and so it starts to become immediately overburdened with paying for these patients. So it usually does two things. It starts to cut benefits, and it starts to drop people from coverage. And this happened, there's been these all these attempts at the state level since the late 80s, something like at least 8 states have tried to institute these public insurance systems, and they all eventually fell apart.
Right.
They didn't, over time, reduce the amount of uninsured patients. They didn't bring down healthcare costs because the states didn't have the money and to cover all these patients.
Pool,
you need to have everyone paying into it, and you need to have a government regulation of the costs of you know, the way it's done in countries where the doctors are paid through the state.
It's not complicated.
And the thing about the American, the U.S. healthcare system is we essentially have two parallel systems. We spend twice as much as most other industrialized countries in the world. We spend as much on public healthcare as other industrialized countries do with national insurance systems. Then we have this whole private insurance apparatus that we spend a similar amount of money on. It's incredibly inefficient, right? You know, when people talk about the efficiencies of capitalism, it's just like capitalism isn't interested in inefficiencies. It's interested in profit. And often inefficiencies are very profitable.
Yes.
So when this is the kind of healthcare system that we're left with, that is just all just completely jerry-rigged, and is massively profitable for the industry and delivers some of the worst health outcomes in the industrialized world.
Yep, it does. And someday, maybe in my lifetime, there won't be for-profit health insurance companies. We do a lot better without it. We're going to talk about, you know, how we can push Hillary Clinton. I'm suspecting on the healthcare issues, there probably are a bunch of groups, organizations, movements that will be pushing her. I wanted to move on. We don't have that much time left. Bernie Sanders called climate change the most important national security issue. Hillary Clinton never said anything like this. As your article points out, Clinton supports some policies opposed by the dirty energy industry. She does. Yet, it's reasonably well known that she got a lot of support from this very industry, petroleum and carbon-intensive industry. She supports fracking. So if she wins, she'll go into office not terrible on climate change, but not really great either. Tell us what should be expected from her if she wins, without push from the left on the issue of climate change, do you think? And on what issues do you think she'll need a push on climate change?
Well, they're talking about, you know, instituting, I think it's a 30% cut by 2025, you know, based on current levels or 2005 levels. And that sounds significant. But the problem is a lot of that is already baked in. You know, for one, the Obama administration has been dramatically revising up the auto fuel efficiency standards. So the goal is, I think, towards the end of the 2020s, the vehicle fleet have around a 50 mile per gallon average. A lot of coal-fired power plants are being phased out, but that's just because of costs. That's ironically because of the fracking boom has bought down the price of natural gas, and because of existing regulations on coal-fired power generation makes it more expensive. You know, we've seen significant but not significant enough rise mm-hmm. in renewables and clean energy, particularly wind and solar,
right.
And solar thermal.
Is she going to push on this?
No, and that is going to that's projected to keep increasing as well. So the goals that Clinton sets out are not about any fundamental restructuring of the energy mm-hmm. economy of, mm-hmm. of society that we need. You know, to get to the net zero carbon emissions, mm-hmm. which we need to get to by mid-century, and is doable, you have to see dramatic social economic changes.
I wonder how much she can be pushed on this. I mean, I wonder still, you know, energy consumption, we seem to be constantly addicted to large capital-intensive plants, nuclear, whatever. But to create a lot of jobs, and I think there's, at least she gives lip service to creating new jobs, and I think she probably means it, there need to be smaller, decentralized facilities coupled with serious conservation issues. I can guess that there's, once again, a lot of money involved at the energy production and distribution industry. They're very powerful indeed. Where is she currently on energy generation? Is she just, you know, in line with the large capital-intensive nuclear whatever facilities and the power of the utility industries?
She doesn't really take a stance on the nuclear industries. And, yeah, you know, I think one of the WikiLeaks emails, it said something they were complaining about environmental activists as crazy, and you know they want me to say that I'll never, you know, commit to phasing out fossil fuels, and the email says something like that's never going to happen. Get a life. I think that makes it pretty clear, you know, where she stands. And you know, let's also be clear that the Obama administration really worked overtime to undercut policy to address climate change at a global level, that they really undermine the tenets of, you know, having a coordinated global response about transferring funds and technologies to developing countries. And, you know, just to tie this back to, you know, what we talked about in the beginning, this is all about income and wealth redistribution in particular.
Yeah.
You know, we could name the companies that are responsible for the climate crisis. It's you know, you're talking perhaps only a few thousand companies, and many of them, their lineage go back to the 19th century. They're the ones who have been responsible for turning the atmosphere into their carbon dump. And profiting at the expense of all of humanity. And that wealth needs to be redistributed. It needs to be done in a smart way to help, you know, nations and people throughout the world develop, to have sustainable lifestyles and, you know, to have much better quality of life.
It's got to be pushed.
It's all certainly doable.
Yes, it is.
But it's going to take wealth redistribution, right? And it's linked to all the other things we talked about. We have to have an internationalist perspective. Oxfam estimated at one point it would take about $100 billion a year over 20 years, you know, to really target and give everyone in the world, you know, clean water, give them health care, give them housing, adequate nutrition, development for jobs, you know, and that sounds like a lot of money, but it pales
in
comparison to the bank bails out. It pales in comparison to the U.S. Military budget, which when you combine all the parts in it and the debt servicing is around $1 trillion a year. You know, we can certainly do this, but the reason we don't do this is because the powerful do not want to give up their power.
Yep.
And you know, in the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a fight. And so the lesson that folks need to take after November 8th is hopefully Clinton will win, but whoever is going to be in office, it's going to be a hard struggle, and we need to be in this, people need to be in the streets fighting.
That's right.
And demanding and disrupting, you know, not violently, that's what the state does, but disrupting the system to force these concessions from them. They are not going to give any ground willingly. Every inch has to be fought for.
That's true. It always has been that way throughout history. And one of the things we didn't even touch on is her hawkish foreign policy. People are going to have to push hard on that. That's the thing that really concerns me a lot. And again, it's the power of money and organized money, as FDR warned against. Our guest, thank you so much for being with us. Arun Gupta, graduate of the French Culinary Institute. His new book is Bacon as a Weapon of Mass Destruction, a Junk Food-Loving Chef's Inquiry into Taste. That sounds really interesting. He's written for the Washington Post, The Nation. We're going to need to push, no question about it. I hope we can push Hillary Clinton, because we sure as heck can't push the other guy. Thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. We're all in it together.
Thanks for having me, Bert.
pushing too hard, pushing too hard.